I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. The phrase, you can't judge a book by its cover, can also apply to buildings, specifically the Birch Bayh Federal Building and United States Courthouse on the corner of Pennsylvania and Ohio Streets in downtown Indianapolis. The stately structure is an example of the Beaux-Arts style of architecture, and it exudes a rather formal, all-business kind of look on the outside. But inside are mosaics, marble statues, and highly detailed paintings. I recently took one of the free guided tours of the building to see and learn more about these hidden works of art.
The courthouse opened in 1905, and when it first opened, it was both the courthouse and the post office. So the post office occupied the whole first floor, which is the space that you see here with all of its arched windows, the mosaic tile ceilings, and then we have recreations of the postal windows and some post boxes as well. I'm Doria Lynch. I am the outreach coordinator, court historian, and administrative specialist here for the Southern District of Indiana. There were 925 people in the building when we opened in September of 1905. The addition went on in the late 1930s during the Great Depression to give some more office space for various new government agencies and things like that. Tours are open to anybody who can accommodate the court's schedule. Of course, we're not open on the weekends. We're not open on federal holidays. So we give the tours typically between 9 and 4 weekdays. But we get everybody from school groups who come through, senior citizen groups, Daughters of the American Revolution have been through recently, conference groups that are in town can come through. Staircases. So we have two sets of these semi-spiral staircases, one on the east end of the building and one on the west end of the building. So I started here as an intern when I was in graduate school, getting my master's in public history. In my second year of grad school, a position for a history intern opened up here, and I worked with a law clerk at the time named Perry Seacrest. He had written a tour script, and so I began memorizing that tour script and then doing further research into the history of the building, the artists, the architects, and all the little pieces that make these stories really come to life besides just being pretty things to look at on the walls.
That, he put a lot of thought. It's like you don't realize how much thought goes into something like this.
Right.
It's so amazing.
The employees, I think, appreciate the tours even more than the general public. You can get a little jaded when you work in a beautiful place. You kind of put your blinkers on and you're just going to work. When you stop to take the tour, you're forced to look up, you're forced to look around and appreciate all these details, you know, the colors, the marble, the textures.
My name is LaMonica Smith. My office is actually on the fourth floor. I wanted to come on the tour because I knew nothing about this building. And so when I first walked in, my very first day, I'm looking around. I'm like, this is impressive. I had heard that there were some parts of the building there you couldn't get to and different things like that. I thought, I'm going to be, you know, working at this building, I want to know about it. I want to know how to get around and what's on the floors and, you know, what's available.
I think it's fun to hear the stories. The stories are good. They're interesting. There's a lot of people involved in the stories, and it helps sort of center us. As they were discussing this space, they kept coming back to one name, and that name was Grant Christian. And he was an artist local to Indiana who had entered other Treasury Relief Art Project competitions, but he'd never won. He was only 24 years old. He'd just graduated from the Heron School of Art and had spent a year in France continuing his education. He'd come back home, and as they looked at this space, they thought back to one of the themes that he'd proposed for another mural, which was to show change over time, to do these physical timelines of Indiana history. And so they actually ended up canceling the competition and just gave the award to this 24-year-old artist. It came with a $5,000 prize, which, you know, 1935 for a 24-year-old artist in the middle of the Great Depression was pretty big.
So the history that is included in each portion, whether it be the marble, the murals, every single detail is just amazing. I'm just in awe.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my
Yeah, it's a great spot, isn't it? So this is one of two of the original courtrooms in the building. Each courtroom and each courthouse was a little bit different. So this courtroom has got what I call the tiger stripe theme. You know, we've got this orange marble with the black stripes running through it. Judge Barker's courtroom, which is of the same time, has pink marble. So it was very much, an effort to impress and awe people when they came into a courtroom in those days. Now, if you go into one of our modern courtrooms, they're all wood paneled, the ceilings are lower, there's no, you know, murals behind the judge's bench and things like that, because justice now is meant to be more accessible to people. Back then, it was meant to sort of awe them and quiet them and make them feel small. Now people are meant to feel part of the process.
Love opening these gates. Yes. It's just such a dramatic effect.
Push those open and walk into a space like this. The Sarah Evans Barker courtroom, named in honor of Judge Sarah Evans Barker, who was appointed by President Reagan in 1984 and was the first woman to be named as a federal judge in the state of Indiana. Same stained glass windows that you saw in the other courtroom. Now the murals that you see, the frieze murals that you see, give the names of 6 Supreme Court Chief Justices and 7 Associate Justices. You see the names Livingstone, Matthews, and Rutledge. Well, we've had a Justice Matthews on the U.S. Supreme Court, and now we've actually had 2 justices by the name of Rutledge, but we've never had a Livingstone. We've had a Livingston with no E at the end, but apparently the artist either wasn't a great speller or had some bad information and painted it as Livingstone. The artist's name was Sidney Newton Sanner. Now, here's an interesting thing about these murals. These are not original to the room. These date to the 1930s and were installed at a time when the courtroom was not in use. These paintings were not funded by the government. In fact, we don't know who funded them at all. And we did not know they existed until about 20 years ago. At some point, probably in the 50s or 60s, they were painted over and forgotten about. What we suspect is that the judge at the time, the one who occupied the other courtroom, was maybe friends with the artist, and perhaps paid him and selected the names that we see here today. The only reason we know the artist's name was that 3 women came to the courthouse and asked to see the murals that their father had painted during the Great Depression. Well, the staff at the time took them up to the 3rd-floor murals where we just were, and they said, oh, here you go. And they said, no, our dad painted murals in a courtroom. And it was only through happenstance that these women were in town for a family wedding and came to see their dad's artwork that we discovered anything about the artist at all. He didn't sign them at all. As they say, there's no financial records that apply to these. He was active in the local civic theater. He was not known as an artist. He holds a number of patents for things like catamarans, but was not known for his artistic ability.
Now, isn't there some controversy about one of the judges?
Yes. So Justice Taney's name is in our rear right corner. And Justice Taney was the author of the Dred Scott decision, which said that African Americans, free and slave alike, were not and could not be citizens of the United States. Of course, the 14th Amendment did away with that decision, but the name of Taney still represents that deep-seated racism in the United States and in legal history. So there have been conversations and discussions about what to do with this particular panel. The issue that the group discussed with Taney's mural is that his name is in a place of celebration and honor in this courtroom. It's not, you know, just you know, a picture outside among other pictures in chronological order. No, this name represents a lot of hurt and a lot of anger in a number of different communities, and the question is, how does the court address that? Do we do that through education on tours like these, where we make sure we talk about it, or do we make an alteration to the mural itself? And if so, what type of alteration?
Will you look at art and buildings in a whole new way now?
Absolutely. I think, again, it's more of the story behind it. And, you know, if you just look at the building, it's like, oh, it's a beautiful building. The architecture is wonderful, but it's the story behind that really intrigues me more so.
You know, we've been here 113 years. There's a lot that's happened in this building in that time. It's not just another place to go to work each day.
Each week we feature an Indiana DIY or do-it-yourself artist who is making it. This week, WFYI's Melissa Davis speaks with a working musician who plays an instrument that isn't always easy to deal with.
Hi, my name is Nick Tucker, and I'm making a career playing bass. Playing bass allows me to make a career out of music. Everybody needs a bass player, and I'm happy to be that person that falls in line and makes the low notes. As a bass player, I get to play all different kinds of music. I'm primarily a jazz musician, but I play a little hip-hop, I play some rock music, I play a little bit of everything. And bass allows me to do that, which I'm very happy about. If you've never seen an upright bass or acoustic bass, it's very large. It stands probably a foot taller than I do. And no, I don't wish I played the flute. And no, it is not a cello. So my career as a bass player, it's been made up of a lot of different pieces. So now I'm in my fourth year of teaching at Ball State University, and that is kind of my primary job. But by having that, I'm afforded the opportunity to freelance kind of whatever I want to do. So I get to play jazz. I get to play in creative groups that I care about, and I get to compose. I get to write music. I get to lead my own band.
Can you tell me about your bands and how many bands you're in here in Indianapolis?
Yeah, sure. So here in Indianapolis, I play in a lot of different groups. So I co-lead the Tucker Brothers group with my brother, Joel Tucker, and that's kind of our original modern jazz group. So when I compose, that's the group that I primarily compose for. I'm also in a band, Clint Breeze in the Groove. It's like a crossover jazz and hip-hop group that is very artistically rewarding for me, and we play a lot of fun shows, so I love that band. I work with the American Pianists Association. This is my second time doing their quadrennial jazz competition, and that's really cool because I get to play with five of the best jazz pianists in the country.
What motivates you to stay this busy?
I have a kind of insatiable hunger for music, and music has kind of always been the only thing I saw myself doing. So I feel like I'm 30 now, I'm not old, I've got a lot of energy, and I'm putting it where I want to, and that's in music. And so I have a steady teaching job, and I probably don't need to play out and gig as much as and grind as much as I do, but I love the grind, and it keeps me energized and excited about music. And you know, one of my biggest fears is that music will become stale to me, and so far it hasn't.
What keeps you going with your art?
I'm very lucky to be surrounded by creative people, and my wife is an artist and a musician. My brother is a great musician. All of my friends are musicians for the most part. And being surrounded by people that understand what I do for a living and care about what I do for a living, and being in a city that kind of supports me, I think all of those things keep me going as a musician. Sometimes I wonder, like, maybe life would have been easier if I would have, you know, gone a different route and tried to make a career somewhere else. But I kind of look back at how things have gone and where I am now, and I wouldn't change anything. I think what keeps me going in my art is what's always kept me going, and that's my love for music.
Photographer Susan Kurt is showcasing her love of botany and photography thanks to a grant from the Indiana Arts Commission. Curious Mix contributor Lee DeNoon takes us to the rare natural habitat called dune and swale, found in northern Indiana.
Armed with cameras and a new drone, Susan Kurt loves to wander through pristine natural areas hidden within industrialized northwest Indiana near Lake Michigan. Kurt is amazed at what animals and plants are thriving.
Right at our feet, we have one of our orchids.
We're on the property of ArcelorMittal Steel.
So the orchids like it on the little bit drier ridges. I go 3 feet and I won't be in the right habitat for this orchid. But along this edge, I see two right now. The orchid that is around here, the Great Plains Orchid, is actually one of our orchids that has a really great smell to it, but it only grows within maybe up to 10 inches from the ground. So you have to basically lay on the ground to take photos of it.
Kurt says dune and swale areas were created when Lake Michigan slowly receded a few thousand years ago, leaving sand dunes with wetter depressions in between the dunes called swales.
If I came back thousands of years ago and I time traveled, I'm at the shore of Lake Michigan right now, which is also kind of fun to think about. I'm like, I'm at the old lake shore. And then as it receded quite rapidly, geologically speaking, over a few thousand years, it left these sandy dunes and it left the wetlands behind.
Kurt says the plants that grow in the wetland are distinctly different than the ones that grow on the higher, drier dunes, just a few feet apart. This 10-acre property is nestled between an interstate and the Gary Airport.
My name is Matt Bartz. I work with ArcelorMittal Research. I am the custodian of a restored dune and swale area here at ArcelorMittal Global Research and Development in East Chicago, Indiana.
Bart says over the years, the company considered developing the property or selling it.
And we always kind of knew there was something going on there because we'd see flowers, you know, wildflowers growing every now and then, but we really never did anything with it. And then we work with the Field Museum with a lot of projects, and we donate a lot of money to them for their projects and stuff. So with them and some other people from the Nature Conservancy, they came out and they kind of looked at it and said, you've got a really nice dune and swale area here. You guys really should try and do something with it.
Bart says the first thing they did was stop mowing it. And Kurt says it's been exciting to watch the native plants bounce back.
So here, what came back naturally is a little over 100 native species of plant that were able to survive the mowing over several decades, including several state-listed endangered and threatened plants.
Kurt's Indiana Arts Commission project will offer drone footage and macro views of dune and swale.
We have all this rare habitat with rare birds and animals and insects and flowers, and people aren't aware of it.
And Kurt is always thinking of new ways to reveal what's hidden.
What I'm hoping to do in the next couple of weeks, I haven't mentioned to Matt yet, is come out, stay here after dark, and put up a sheet to see what kind of moths can come to the sheet so that I can take pictures of them and get them identified.
Kurt's photography is featured in a Chicago Field Museum guide on native plants, and she has a website of her own, SusanKurtPhotography.com. For Curious Mix, I'm Lee DeNoon.
Still to come on Curious Mix, Fearless Flavor.
There's a brave people that can order Thai hot. We do that too.
And Picture Perfect.
Can you tell how our high heels sank into the ground as we stood under the live oak, grinning for the mix and match of family group shots?
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Thousands of musicians from around the world recently gathered in Indianapolis to celebrate all things percussion. Curious Mix contributor Kyle Long takes us to PASIC, the Percussive Arts Society International Convention.
PASIC covers the entire spectrum of percussion music, from symphonic timpanists to hip-hop beat makers. As I wandered through the exhibition halls at PASIC, I watched performances from Sam Ul Nori, a traditional Korean percussion ensemble. Taiwan's Jew percussion group performed contemporary Taiwanese art music on the marimba. Percussion masters Paoli Mejia and Carl Perazzo demonstrated Cuban rumba rhythms. PASIC also offers attendees the chance to talk shop with legendary figures from the percussion world. I was shocked to run into Emil Richards during the convention. Emil was here to induct his friend Joe Porcaro into the PASIC Hall of Fame. Emil is best known for his extensive session work with artists like George Harrison and Frank Zappa, but I'm a huge fan of Emil's microtonal blues band. The group released two psychedelic jazz albums on Impulse Records, inspired by the microtonal music of the iconoclastic American composer Harry Parch. Here's an excerpt of my talk with Emil.
What did it mean to you to induct your friend and longtime collaborator Joe into the Percussion Hall of Fame?
It was a little sad because he's older than I am and he should have got in a lot before I did.
Yeah. Well, better late than never, right? What do you think took so long for people to recognize his particular genius?
I don't know. I just probably had a few more years out in L.A. and got a little more exposure than he did, but he's been certainly deserving from the beginning.
Yeah, and I want to ask one question about your work. What inspired you to create the microtonal marimba music you recorded with Impulse and performed during the late 60s? I love that music, and it's one of a kind.
I got connected with a composer by the name of Harry Parch, and he had 41 tones to the octave, and that's what did it for me.
So that project was a direct response to the music of Harry Parch and what you learned from his compositions and orchestra of instruments. But you were taking it into a more improvisational realm than Parch did, because his music was like thoroughly composed, right?
Yes, right.
What did he make of what you were doing?
He liked it, but he was really interested in his theories mostly, you know.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Richards. Huge fan of yours, so honored to meet you. Take care.
I also ran into Daru Jones at PASIC. Daru shot to fame for his work with the White Stripes' Jack White. But Daru is best known for his work translating hip-hop beats on the drum kit. Daru is currently the music director for the Soul Brothers, a group founded by the legendary hip-hop beatmaker Pete Rock. I asked Daru for his thoughts on PASIC and tested his knowledge of Indianapolis hip-hop breaks.
It's nothing like being around this environment. All percussionists, drummers, it's like we're one big family. Every time I leave here, I always go inspired and ready, just feel burning, you know.
How many PASICs have you attended in the past?
And somebody else asked me that today, too. Yeah. I want to say between 12 and 15, through the years.
How did hip-hop inform your playing style?
That's a good question. By me being a producer, you know, I always gravitated, you know, towards it was a certain era of producers that I was into, you know, Dr. Dre, DJ Premier. And what I like about Premier and, like, producers like Pete Rock, they were sampling jazz. You know, at one time, everybody was using all, like, James Brown records, but they started sampling jazz, and I was recognizing the samples, you know, some things that I know the original, where they got the samples from. But just that breakbeat, just that loop, you know what I'm saying? That's been a big part, you know what I'm saying, of what I know. And I started hearing about the breakbeats, and then when I found out where the breakbeats came from, And just it was just genius how they just took one part and just kept looping it. And I was like, I want to definitely incorporate that.
One last question for you. Since we're here in Indianapolis, are you familiar with any of the great Indianapolis breaks like Cool Is Back, Funk Incorporated, Harlem Parade Strut, J.J. Johnson?
No, you just cracked my head. You just cracked my head. So that's what's up. Big ups to Indianapolis pioneers, you know what I'm saying? That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. You put me on.
Yeah.
The most memorable performance I witnessed this year at PASIC featured Cindy Blackman Santana. Cindy is a jazz drummer at heart. She's best known for her work in rock music. Cindy has performed extensively with Lenny Kravitz and Carlos Santana. I asked Cindy why attending PASIC is important for her.
You can get back into a space where you see people who are working on a craft, you know, working on actually playing an instrument instead of just pushing buttons. You know, I mean, people are really learning how to play the drums, playing the drums and appreciating that, you know. So I love this atmosphere because it's very inducive to creativity and to growth. So to me, these are really not only fun, but they're very important events.
One of the most remarkable aspects of Cindy's playing is the tremendous power she manifests behind the kit. If you're standing nearby, you can literally feel the force of the sound waves hitting your body. During a talk after her performance, Cindy shared a memory from her early years. She recalled learning American Sign Language from her childhood friend, Doug. In exchange for the lessons, Cindy would play for Doug, who would dance in rhythm to the waves of sound emanating from her drums. I asked Cindy what those moments with Doug taught her about the power of percussion.
It meant the world because it taught me that, you know, you can communicate to somebody with music no matter what. You know, it you know, breaches language barriers, social barriers, cultural barriers, racial barriers. You know, it breached with Doug and I, it breached his being a deaf mute. You know, he was able to feel the pulse. So again, as I said in the clinic, you know, it made me understand and see at a very young age how important that is and how universal that is. And it made me think about the flow of the universe, you know, the flow of frequency and energy and what that can do positively to another person, you know. So to be able to yield that to me was such a gift. You know, I appreciated it and was thankful for it even then, and now even more.
For Curious Mix, I'm Kyle Long.
If you're looking to perk up your palate, it's time to get a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know the tastiest places in town when it comes to ethnic eats. They say that crab-fried rice at Faya Thai Street Food will make your mouth water.
My name is Montri Sangsawangu, and my wife is Tanyani Yupipat. We both are the owners right here at Faya Thai Street Food. I got a kitchen out here in the dining room. You know, this is a street food style, originally back in the street of Bangkok. This one here called crab fried rice with combination of garlic and, you know, onion, what have you. And of course, we use a real crab meat. It's one outstanding dish. We start with a little bit of oil and garlic. We use a lot of garlic in cooking, Thai cooking. And then we'll put a little bit of eggs in there, you know, scramble. Those are eggs scrambled that we go in there so it's soften up everything. And then we add the crab meat. This way the crab meat is cooked and it got mixed in with the garlic and onions. And then we'll process to start cooking the fried rice, the white rice. Get it hot, get it good ingredients. And that's when we start put the crab meat right in there and mix it all together. We always give choice to the people to the spicy, my medium hot. People that like hot food, they'll intend to order medium. You know, if they want it not too hot, then they do mine. You know, this is street food style, so we really intend. If it's medium, it's hot. I will tell people, medium is hot. Hot is hot. There's a brave people that can order Thai hot. We do that too.
Baya Thai Street Food is located at 5645 North Post Road near Fort Harrison in Indianapolis. How does a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
Since I'm a photographer, I was looking to see what kind of poems out there have something to do with photography or cameras, and it's kind of hard to find. And the conceit of this poem is she describes this wedding she went to through the story of someone stealing her camera and looking at the pictures on the film that within the camera, which hardly even exists anymore if you think about it. You know, I remember finding a roll of film in the back seat of my car once, you know, 20 years ago, and being kind of excited because I wasn't sure what was on it, and getting it processed. And to tell you the truth, there was nothing exciting. But, you know, that feeling doesn't exist for people now. We're using our phones. It's kind of neat. We're, you know, used to there'd be 24 exposures on a roll. And you were very careful about what you photographed because it was going to be an expense to get it processed. And of those 24 pictures, if you had two or three that were good, you were lucky. But even if they were bad, we'd put them in photo albums because it costs 50 cents to process, and we're not going to waste that money. So we would have albums of photographs. And those days are almost gone. So this, long story short, it's too late to be a short story, but that's what attracted me to this poem. The fact that she's talking about the days that weren't too long ago about cameras and film. And like I said, this poem is by Laura Fargus. It's called "To the Person Who Stole My Camera." You know who you are. Who am I? Not the bride, but someone in the same room. As she and her maids leaned fish-mouthed into the mirror, putting on lipstick under a calm gaze of a stuffed pronghorn buck. You can't feel how soft his hide is, nor hear the homely music the chatter of ants was sending up to the stairs. Where are the cups, dear? Emily, careful with that lamp now. The colors, you might have those, blue bonnet, wine cup, yellow weesach, and foamy fields of white bull nettle. The steers of Crocker Ranch, dun and red and brown, stared from fenced-off range, while a light wind tossed the ladies' dresses. Can you tell how our high heels sank into the ground as we stood under the live oak, grinning for the mix and match of family group shots? There is the preacher, tall and spare, in his clerical collar and cowboy hat, his armadillo-bound outsized Bible cradled respectively in the crook of his elbow, saying that he surely does love performing a marriage. Yes, that is me in the red dress and pink carnation, one of the sisters, leaning against the big whitewashed house where my new brother-in-law grew up, eating German cake off the napkin. And isn't it a terrific day? Welcome to the wedding.
She still had a good memory even without her pictures.
She did. Maybe it made her think a little bit harder about what happened. I can sure see that the wedding in my mind.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next week with another focused poem. Up next on Curious Mix, teamwork.
Everyone in the audience basically has to pick a different ones in order for us to get the full sound of the piece.
And true grit.
I am not one for getting in and doing every hair on the head.
that would drive me nuts.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. A global holiday event took place in Indianapolis one cold winter's eve. Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams was there and tells us why it's called Un-Silent Night.
Most good stories start at the beginning. But for context, this one has to start in the middle of an engaging, delightful, eclectic, sub-freezing, mid-teen wind chill stroll around downtown Indianapolis with about another dozen intrepid souls playing, well, that's why the story begins here. You're participating in a worldwide community holiday experiential music walk. Yes, that's a mouthful. So let's go to the beginning now and a pre-event conversation in the warmth of an indie coffee shop with Eric Salazar of Classical Music Indy and the new music ensemble Forward Motion, who brought this event to Indianapolis.
Un-Silent Night began originally in 1992. With Phil Klein. He's the composer of this piece, and it's actually a global phenomenon. Many cities, New York City, London, Melbourne, Australia, many cities across the world perform this piece, and it is essentially a boombox caroling parade where the audience helps perform the piece of music. So everyone gathers in one spot, and then there's a countdown, and then everyone hits play on whatever device they're using. It can be a cell phone, because there's an app. It can be a boombox with tape, a cassette, or CD. And everyone hits play at the same time, and then you begin your walk, and you walk around for about 45 minutes, and that's how long the piece is. And in Indianapolis, Forward Motion, which I'm the director of, it's a new music ensemble here in town. We performed this last year in Fountain Square, and it was successful, and this year we're doing it downtown, beginning the performance of Un-Silent Night on Monument Circle.
For those who don't have any boombox handy at the moment, can you hum Bill Klein's piece that you're going to be asking everybody to play?
So the piece is an electronic composition, so you do need an electronic device to play it. We bring about a dozen boomboxes. The piece has four parts. So there's four different cassettes, four different CDs, four different audio files. And so everyone in the audience basically has to pick a different ones in order for us to get the full sound of the piece. And so if you've got a cell phone, you don't need to bring a big boombox unless you really want to throw back to the 80s and carry around a boombox.
So, per instructions, we all met on the north side of Monument Circle, the dark side, if you will. There were fewer people than last year's Fountain Square walk, but as one participant put it, it was 30 degrees warmer. With boomboxes, amplified cell phones, and old push-button cassette players, we walked for 45 minutes around downtown from Monument Circle, east to Delaware, then west to Victory Field, then ending up at the Percussion Museum of Washington and Illinois, all the while playing this four-part piece of esoteric electronica, seasonal-ish music. Think tubular bells, and you know what? It was fun. Join us as we interact with our city.
Is everyone ready?
So we're
now
starting for real.
No, this is for real.
This is for real.
All right. 1, 2, 3, start.
Really minus that one out.
this is cool. It's confusing. Yeah. Very confusing. That's cool.
I interviewed Eric at the coffee shop.
Oh, yeah?
I did ask him to hum a few bars.
Oh, did he ask? That's
he couldn't hum a few bars.
No, probably not. It sounds like a cathedral.
Yes, it does.
We finished at the Rhythm Discovery Center at Illinois and Washington. Never heard of it? It's a creative vision of the Percussive Arts Society, and it's worth a scheduled visit. This night, it was closed to everyone but us, where we enjoyed a short concert of original compositions performed by Forward Motion, that new music ensemble. Eric Salazar is a clarinetist and co-founder of the sextet. The performance might be best described as a tapas performance. Small plate, absolutely delicious, and craving for more. Oh, and there was that much appreciated hot cocoa. There's been an assurance of another on Silent Night. Just where? Not sure yet. For Curious Mix, this is Bob Williams.
Art and travel have always been an important part of life for one of the newest residents in the Circle City Industrial Complex on the Indianapolis Near East Side. Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez introduces us to this visual explorer.
Their actual name is Prairie Module 1 and Prairie Module 2.
Roberta Avador travels all over downtown Indianapolis without ever leaving the walls of her studio, one of the newer additions to the Circle City Industrial Complex.
That's Coat Check Coffee. City Market, right? That's one of my favorite places. The light streaming in the morning was just, I felt like I needed to do that, do something with that.
Light plays a big part in Avador's paintings. A large piece featuring the Soldiers and Sailors Monument in the center of downtown comes to life through its shadows. Her City Market painting, on the other hand, lives through the light streaming from windows, through the green girders on the ceiling. From a distance, the paintings are almost like photographs capturing a scene. This is due, in large part, to Avador's career as a storyboard artist in advertising.
The thing they were concerned about, the art directors, was, does it read? Do we know what it is? Does it read? If you could do that and get the job done in time, they were just really grateful.
Born in Indianapolis, Avador's father's work kept the family moving around. She claims Kalamazoo, Michigan, as the city where she grew up. When it came time for a career in the 1970s, it was off to art school, Parsons, in New York City.
New York City was a completely different place back then. When I went to art school, I just want to learn how to draw and paint, but then we had to pick a, you know, specialty. And I was in fashion illustration, but at that time, that was a dying industry, and it's dead now, unfortunately. You cannot depend on that to make a living. Photography was more in use because the printing got so much better. So, you know, everything went that way. My aunt was who was my mentor there in New York City. She was a fashion artist, but she was in the heyday. And that was that had a lot of influence on me. Until quite recently, in one form or another, I always worked for advertising. So I was a storyboard artist. I had to do scenes. And got used to doing scenes, and that's why part of the reason probably why I'm still intrigued with doing them today.
Avador is an avid people watcher, and it's reflective in her work.
A lot of these places I consider a commons. You can see people gathering, and even though Coat Check is, you know, that's a business, but it's almost like a commons because you see people sitting there for hours on end.
After art school, Avador worked freelance and built a steady career in visualizing others' ideas.
They call you up and say, are you available to churn out 12 frames by tomorrow end of day? Oh, it was always horrible deadlines. Horrible. I would come in. This is before the internet, you know, they couldn't send anything. You'd come in and they would give you the script and they would give you the rough balloon heads, I call them stick figures. And they would describe what they were looking for. It was always broken down into approximately 11 to 12 frames. I would usually show them pencils because I'd say, this is a stage where you change it. If you change it when I get to doing after the color work and the line work, it's going to cost you.
By the 1980s, real estate prices in New York led Avador and her husband west, to the Midwest. Maybe Indianapolis? A return to her roots?
Actually, my husband Ken and I checked this place out in 1985 and nixed it. It didn't seem like, even though I was born here and have a little bit of history, it didn't seem anything special, and there was more opportunity up in Minnesota where we ended up. So more opportunity job-wise.
Over the years, the Avadors have traveled the country by train for vacations and family visits. Along the way, Roberta has kept journals, not page after page of written word, but watercolor or pencil drawings capturing the scenes viewed from her rail car window with short notations.
If you carry a sketchbook with you wherever you go, you're never bored. Sunday, September 16th, we board the Coast Starlight from L.A. getting off at San Jose. As the golden hour approached, I felt compelled to capture the light on the miles and miles of produce being grown. Monday, September 17th, Shauna takes us to Pescadero Beach. A young woman mourns the dead seal that washed up on the sand.
That's a dead seal.
I had to record this. And she was sitting cross-legged, like meditating over this dead seal. This is California.
Bicycling is another family passion. The Avadors were bike activists in Minnesota, but were disappointed with the amount of bike-friendly travel options, such as painted lanes on the roadways. The pair visited Indianapolis in 2017, shortly after race day, and fell in love with the cultural trail. This is a much different Indy than the city they passed on in the 1980s.
We were so impressed with what they've done here. I mean, it's different. It's like night and day. This is how I get around. I don't own a car. Being able to bike in the city on a separated path is heaven.
The internet has made it possible to take on freelance work from anywhere, and now was the time to make Indianapolis their home. The Avadors have immersed themselves in local cycling meetups and rides, and Roberta has joined the Indy Urban Sketchers, a group meeting monthly downtown to sketch life in sight. No photos are allowed, and that's just fine with Avador. In the rest of her work, including her larger paintings, she prefers quick studies over photos.
I do take reference photos, but I don't want to work solely from photos.
Why is that?
I think it tightens me up too much. I like to develop the imagination, and so that's why I like to do a loose watercolor.
She paints representationally and prides her more relaxed hand in her recent work over her nearly realistic earlier pieces. Avador is capturing indie scenes, but she's doing it her way.
The painting goes faster. I am not one for getting in and doing every hair on the head. That would drive me nuts.
For Curious Mix, I'm Joy Hernandez.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this Curious Mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Melissa Davis,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Kyle Long,
Joy Hernandez,
Matt Pelser,
Bob Williams,
Lee Danoon,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.